Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
G'day, welcome aboard the Starship Zero G, science fiction, fantasy and historical radio for episode number 1571, entitled More Pandoramonium. Our podcast title is A Poodle Rain.
Oh, nice.
Thanks and appreciation to Ivka Taylor-Moss for passing the salt so well for the last 4 weeks of her show. Yes. And also thanks to the show before us today, The Fabric with General Vibes and Mother Funk. I believe Kate Reid will be coming up after Zero G today, Astral Glamour's spot. I'm Rob Jan.
And Megan McHugh, and we are back from our little Christmas break. Mm.
Welcome back to listeners too.
Mm.
Or listeners too, as in also not the number two. So, Megan, what was the highlight of your break?
Great question. I think definite highlight was doing nothing, the no work part. But I did get a chance to catch up on quite a bit of reading, which was great. Churned through quite a few sort of TV shows that I hadn't had a chance to catch yet. Some sat outside of genre. I caught up with the Sarah Snook All Her Fault, which was shot in Melbourne. A little bit of a suburban thriller, that one, like a domestic murder mystery.
Sarah Snook. Isn't she like the Star Wars First Order leader's sister? I don't know, something like that.
But
I'm actually reading one of the books that you gave me for Christmas.
Tell me more.
The one about the future retro exploration of the poets.
Yes, the Ian McEwan.
Mm. So it was a bit of a space shuttle pilot's holiday for me. Mm-hmm. I spent a bit of time listing things I enjoyed about 2025 on the Zero G Facebook page. Not too many real life things, to be sure.
In this day and age, can be tricky.
Except survival, which is never to be discounted. I did get out to explore the new Metro Tunnel Station, which I found quite fascinating.
I do think there's something about it. It is rare to be around for the early days of such big, large-scale city infrastructure. Wow. I think it is pretty interesting to be able to go, just something so brand new at the very start, you know, being able to be here around for that. Okay. I remember doing some research for the Metro Tunnel project 8 years ago before I moved into tech, and it felt so far away, like, who knows what I'll be doing in 2025.
Well, I've seen two now. I was around for the old city loop.
There you go.
It's the same sort
and
of
now
thing.
You get to see the add-on. So, what are your thoughts on the tunnel?
Well, it's an amazing project, and Zero G appreciates the fact that it's clearly designed to be future resilient.
Mm.
I mean, flooding with the climate change aside. But I think that's always a good aspiration, you know. The long platforms for the bigger trains, the wide platforms, the design of the whole thing. Bit amused by the fact that that two of the stations look pretty much identical, which is bad from terms of a person travelling in them.
Yeah,
you can sort of, and I love those because I'm not well travelled really, but seeing the platform screens that stop you from falling into the tracks.
Yeah, and I think just even things like the signage and messaging has now been improved, even in, you know, the old city loop too, just to try and bring it a bit up to par. Because I do think our train system needed a little bit of a makeover, just in terms of things like signage and all of that. So I'm happy to see over time that's also gotten a lot better too.
And I love being able to walk from like Flinders Street Station underground over to Town Hall.
I mean, this is
cool.
The thing, it's very common big cities have multiple train loops for their main CBD hub to like keep the traffic separated and not clog it up. And so we're entering that era where we have the two.
And the way the trams just lock into the Anzac station, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And the little memorials to the World War maybe one as well, carrier pigeons. They've got little statues of carrier pigeons. Nice. So cute.
I think, I mean, it's pretty cool that it's – I mean, I think it's still ramping up, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's – 1st of February is when it sort of goes more fully active.
Yeah,
so now witness the power of our fully operational metro tunnels. Parkville, I got off of Parkville, and I don't spend much time in that area and haven't spent it for a long time. So getting out of the train there and coming up onto the street was like arriving in a different city.
Yeah, yeah.
So where in the multiverse am I?
I know. So you're in a city that has two train lines now, or two train systems.
Two underground train systems. Apparently the, because there's facts and figures everywhere, apparently the furthest south underground train system in the world, beating out Auckland and by a bit.
Wow.
That's important.
Like I said, though, being around as this kind of new stuff gets unveiled,
it's exciting. I was on the train. I don't know if I mentioned this, and there's some terrific young women on the train having a great conversation. You can't hear it. And they're talking about the metro stations and how it allows them to go to places they really want to go. Yeah. And there was a grumpy old man, basically, not me, next to them, who said something like, you'll be paying for it for the rest of your life. Like, first off, intruding on their conversation, which is,
with some negativity as well. Negativity. Come on, mate.
And one of the brilliant young things just said, just confidently just said, well, I don't mind paying for something if everyone also benefits from it.
Oh, great comeback. That's
a great comeback.
Yeah.
Yeah, you go.
And more options for people to take public transport unlocks, a lot more areas.
Then he doubled down. He said, well, that's what cars are for. And she said,
all right, mate.
She said, well, there's a lot of people who don't actually drive.
Is he not on the train at this point?
He was on the train.
Dear.
And then he shut up. So.
Well, she got him, I think. I think we know who won that round.
Now, me being me, I also binge-watched 5 seasons of the remarkably gently whimsical British sitcom Ghosts.
Yes, I'm keen to hear. I've not caught up with this.
As well as looking at the US and Australian adaptations.
Have you really?
I did.
Oh, you've gone serious.
The originals also spun off French, German and Greek iterations as well.
Nice.
Which is an extraordinary supernatural phenomenon in itself. And I'm kicking myself because, like an idiot, it's basically a handful of ghosts manifesting in an English mansion, and a young couple move in, and due to events, the lady of the house ends up being able to see the ghosts, so interacting with them throughout the course of the season.
Yep.
And they come from all different historical periods. Like they've got a man from about 14,000 years in the past, so he's basically like a sort of a caveman kind of thing. But he's actually very sophisticated because he's lived through all this time and learned from other people inhabiting the area and later on the house when it was built.
Yeah, right. So
we've got that guy, we've got a guy from sort of the Renaissance period from the Elizabethan era.
Oh, yeah.
Whose head got chopped off. He's actually played by the same guy who plays the caveman.
Oh, okay.
Because they can.
Yeah.
They've got a couple of women from different periods, one who was burned at the stake, another one who's from a sort of an era. She's a bit of an airhead, but she's all heart. And there's another one who's from the Edwardian period.
Oh, so it's kind of meant to be a little bit of a historical thing.
Yes, but they also have a World War II British captain, who is also gay, and obviously there's some stuff involved in that in World War II, a guy who's a romantic poet from the Victorian era who tragically falls in long-term love with the living woman who moves into the house.
Mm.
And he's so wet, and then there's, I'm sure I've forgotten a few people. Oh, yes, a 1980s British politician who died with his pants off. He's a Tory. And a scout leader.
Yes, I can see that in the promo.
He got killed in an arrow archery-related incident was it the 70s or the 80s or something like that, anyway, around about the same time. So there's a whole bunch of people there, and there's lots of jokes in it. But it, like I said, gently whimsical, really good show.
Okay.
Just binge watched it because I just couldn't stop.
It's only got the 5 seasons.
Yes. Yeah. And they do things like land Christmas episodes really well too, which is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
And there's actually one of those Children in Need comedy films that they made for it, where they cross over with Kylie Minogue, visits the mansion to stage a musical there. So check out that one on the internet.
That's on Stan.
It's on all sorts of places because, you know.
Oh, it's on iView as well.
Yeah, the Australian one. And watching the Australian one, I'm thinking, well, because each of the different countries does their own mix of characters.
Yeah, I was going to say they incorporate their distinct, like they wouldn't all have the same, World War One.
You know, in the American one, there's a Viking.
Okay.
Because the Vikings landed in America and a First Nations man and, you know, all sorts of different mixtures. A 30s, 40s African-American nightclub singer. And then I'm watching the Australian one, which has its own particular mix. There's a 70s disco exercise video woman. Who's still in the headband and the leggings and all, wet leg warmers and the whole bit, and a bikie from modern times. They also have a colonial administrator from the 18th or 19th century, and they don't have an Indigenous ghost. And I'm like an idiot. I'm thinking, oh, I'm a bit disappointed by that. There'd be lots of opportunity. And I realise a person who would be dead. So. Not a good cultural fit to represent on the screen.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, okay. But what they do have is the living woman is actually Indigenous.
There's some representation.
Representation there.
But do you have a pick for which country's version you liked the most? Or
look, because I finished the British one, and that is the original one. That one so far is. To me, far and away the best one. But the American one is actually surprisingly
good. Got some moves. Okay.
Yeah, and the Australian one too. So it's Ghosts. You can find – just check it out. It's on all sorts of streaming.
Yeah, it does look like it's pretty available. That's fun. Mm. Okay, nice.
All right, so look, we acknowledge the traditional owners of country throughout Australia. And recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. So we pay our respects to their elders, past, present and emerging, which is very important for Zero G
in
future terms.
Yes.
And it's a particularly relevant acknowledgement today as well because we will also be looking at a fictional genre story where an off-world culture is experiencing colonisation.
Yes.
So, yeah, Avatar, Fire and Ash.
Tale as old as time.
And, look, I was watching the 1984 movie Purple Rain last night for the first time.
A bit of research.
Well, as far as I, me being me, Prince is the guy who had a track on the Batman movie soundtrack. He used to be known as Prince. And that's it. That's all I know. And I think he died. I think he died as well.
Yes.
And that's it.
His genre connections are light on, so I can kind of see. Yeah. Well, you haven't crossed paths with him as much, yes.
And after watching the movie, I was thinking you can set a movie back in a simulated historical period, but you have to work beyond the point of diminishing returns to completely recreate it as it was.
Mm.
Maybe AI will manage something like that someday. Mm. But I see now how the song Purple Rain is relevant to Stranger Things.
Yes.
But Stranger Things, being a recreation of the 1980s, gets 11 points for trying anyway. And the period that Stranger Things tries to recreate, evoke, runs from November 1983 to November 1987, and there's a flash-forward section in Season 5, the final season, to November 1989. And I think over to you now, Megan, because we are going to first talk about the Stranger Things Season 5.
Yes, so this is probably one of the sort of main things that dropped over the break that we wanted to talk about. We did talk about Stranger Things Season 5 Volume 1 before we took a break. Mm. Shall we hear a little bit of a riff from the score to get us in the mood to go back to Hawkins, Indiana?
Yeah, I'll just cue up the 8-track cartridge.
Squawk, what is it? Squawk Radio? Rock and Rob?
Rock and Rob. And Methodical Megan. Is that too boring?
We'll think of something good while we listen to this.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Bobcat Goldthwait, and you're listening to 3RRR FM Melbourne.
You are indeed, and you are here with Rock and Rob and Musical Megan. I don't know. I didn't really think of anything. That's as far as we went. And we're going to
Marathon. Marathon Megan.
There we go. And we are going to talk a little bit about the wrap-up and the finale of Stranger Things. So I think we're going to try and keep it – we probably don't want to spoil too much in case people are still planning to get along with it, but –
I don't know.
It's hard because then what are we going to discuss?
I feel spoilery.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go in hard then.
Yeah.
I will definitely say then we had kind of left with a big cliffhanger at the end of volume one, which had dropped just before sort of Christmas break. So they dropped volume one, which was episodes 1 to 4. Mm-hmm. And then the plan was in Australia on Boxing Day, we would get episodes 5 to 7. And then the final movie length episode would drop for Australian folks on New Year's Day. So the Duffer Brothers were very much like Christmas and New Year's is going to be fully about the show that we created. And so it had been quite a long wait since season 4, which released back in 2022. And we caught up with the usual gang in volume 1, and it left us with the big cliffhanger of Will. He had reached into the depths of himself and realized that he could in fact tap into Vecna's powers whenever he was near an attached part of the hive mind, and that would indeed unlock abilities of Vecna's that Will could use at his discretion.
That's very much a Dungeons and Dragons move, isn't it?
Yeah. So he basically revealed himself to be a sorcerer could then, we now appear to have another kind of weapon to use in the greater fight that this, our beloved party, our beloved group have been engaged in against Vecna. With the little side quest, of course, of Dr. K, who's running a secret lab on the side that we should not forget about getting into the mix as well.
Linda Hamilton.
Yes.
Reprising her role from Resident Alien.
in volume one, we had increased the size of our party to include a couple of new characters that sort of played a key role. Probably I'd single out here the character of Holly, the youngest Wheeler child, and we were introduced to her character.
Oh, we're calling them the party. That's probably better than the Scoobies.
Yeah. I think we're going to lean, towards the end, it really lent into the D&D analogy, so I think we'll stick with that. But, so Holly revealed herself to be kind of key to this, and we spent a lot of time by the end of volume one and into volume two dipping around inside Vecna's mind, which became one of the key locations, as well as, of course, the town of Hawkins in the real world, and the Upside Down still gets a look in as well. We're juggling a lot of people and places.
But we actually did get this fully explained with blackboard maps and diagrams, and they showed the whole relationship between Hawkins as it is, the Upside Down, the wormhole that links it all to Dimension X as well.
Exactly.
So we've actually had the full explanation.
We did. So I will say we had to go through quite a few exposition drops, but to be honest, what else are they? I mean, I think we have a lot to cover. I'm willing to forgive it because I love a good whiteboarding moment. I love a good little, here's the plan and we're going to map it out using XYZ in place of our characters. And so I feel like there's no other way that could get done.
And it's science fiction, damn it. We deserve to get some principle and procedural as well. That's complicated because it needed to be complicated. We're dealing with a lot of seasons and a lot of stuff in play.
The amount of things that were being juggled throughout not only this season but the whole series. I've seen a lot of chatter about people saying, it was more simple than what I was expecting, etc. I'm like, if we map, there's plot holes here and there. If we map out everything that's happened since the start of that first episode, the Duffer Brothers have kept a lot of balls in the air for a long time, and I think we can forgive them a couple of maybe what the audience feels are kind of plot holes or what have you. But
look, it's going to land differently for everyone.
Exactly. But just to overview kind of what we go through a little bit in volume two and the finale, and we can sort of dig a little bit more deeper into it as well. But like I said, we go on a journey through some of Vector's memories. We learn a little bit more about his origin story. Not a lot, but a little bit more about that. We do see Max finally reunited with the party in the real world. If you'll recall, she's been stuck in Vector's mind and in a coma for basically the season up until now, even though we have seen her up and about inside Vecna's mind. We also, very importantly, get a moment for Will to share some of his truth with the group. And
I just wanted to say, look, I'm perhaps not the person to judge, but it landed very well with me because I felt that they were going to, you know, he comes out basically to his friends. I thought that they were going to do a dismissive sort of hand wave. Oh, we knew that all, you know, we always knew that. But they didn't. They treasured the moment, I thought.
Yeah, and there was a lot of linking as well as to, you know, he'd be able to fully wield the power of Vecna and fully be able to be a true asset to the group if he was comfortable with himself and able to share that when he was ready. Yeah. And so I think that was kind of an important part of the messaging, is that he'd gone on a bit of a journey and that this was something he was choosing to do. And I thought that was a really nice kind of, you're right, they didn't hand wave over that part of the story. It became quite a key part of volume two. We also see that Holly's a little fighter. We saw a lot of the Wheel of Fighting spirit in Holly in volume two and the finale. And speaking of the wheels, we did also see that Karen, the mum, she doesn't need her wine to continue being a menace to demo dogs and demogorgons alike.
Mama bear stuff.
She is tough. She is certainly very tough.
Second only to Joyce.
Yes, absolutely. The mums definitely get their time to shine.
Karen and her wine and her improvised bombs.
And Joyce and her axe. Absolutely.
Which is very 1980, you know, it's the whole Shining thing.
Yeah, very much like, you know, a really visceral weapon there. And as you mentioned, Rob, we learn a bit more about what the Upside Down really is. Mm. We learn about what Dr. K has been hiding in her lab via Carly, who's been reintroduced as a character. She is, of course, one of the...
That took me by surprise.
Yeah, it did me too. I think that the lab and the Dr. K story started to feel a little bit extraneous, like it was something extra we had to deal with in the story at one point.
What it felt like to me, in fact, the whole military involvement in it, it felt like a stage that had expended itself.
Yes.
And was sort of tumbling back to Earth.
It truly felt like, okay, we have to wrap up these loose ends, rather than it being a very, you know, having its own momentum as a plot. It started to feel like it was a bit of dead weight, to be honest.
But this is an interesting side point. Here, sidebar, why is the military presence nowhere to be seen in the flash forward to 1989? Did they just give up?
I suspect so.
But is there no consequences for the Hawken party mowing down US soldiers?
Well, this is it.
Interfering with their covert ops. And then I thought, this is very typical of 80s movies, actually, but it was the 80s, notionally, when exposure of heinous crimes was to be avoided.
Yeah.
And not a feature of the government procedure as it is now. You know, so that's, to me, kind of made sense. And besides which, because I hadn't forgotten about the upside grunts, I call it the upside, went down after the Hawkins party.
Mm-hmm.
No, there were no survivors from that group.
No.
So they told no tales.
Yeah, well, it's self-cleaning. They're mopping up their own messes, I guess.
Yeah. Although still, you'd think, you know, Hopper is back. Being sheriff.
I mean, how? I'm sure this man was thought to be dead. He was, you know, on the run, captured by Russian military forces, and then now he's been reinstated in his role as sheriff?
Look, they're going to hand over all of it to the media if anyone messes with them.
Very strange, very strange. But
oh, actually, we don't know what sort of, let's call them a wet squad, came after Dr. K. Maybe it was all tidied away.
Well, this is the thing is, we'll never know. I mean, that's probably one of the key things.
We might know. There's a spin-off animated series.
Maybe, but I think the Duffer Brothers have said that they're not going to – you're not going to see any of the characters you've seen on screen in Stranger Things again.
Let's hope that Hopper and Joyce end up living happily ever after in Montauk or something like that?
Yeah, so Montauk, I think, in New York. So I think – that's probably key to say as well, is the season, it does really wrap up everything. The last episode spends the last 40 minutes wrapping up, you know, all of its reveals. It gives characters opportunity to connect and confront with each other. I mean, we do see some of that earlier, sort of in the early episodes as well, with Jonathan and Nancy. We kind of wrap up their storyline, give them an opportunity to have some hard conversations. And we do get clear resolutions for everyone's story arc, except perhaps for one key person whose end is left fittingly ambiguous.
And I like the ambiguity of the ambiguity.
Yes. I mean, I would ask you, Rob, what do you believe, or what's your thoughts?
Well, I believe, because they you know, I don't think it's just a story that Mike is making up to make himself feel better.
Mm.
But I'm not sure if he's got the details quite right.
Mm.
Because
interesting.
I do wonder about parts of it. But
I have to say I'm with Sadie Sink on this one.
Yeah. Maybe she – yeah, maybe it's – I don't know.
I don't believe, but I like how that story is wrapped up.
I like that Mike believes.
I very much like – so the season – I mean, we've gone into spoiler territory, so you haven't watched it. You're already in dangerous territory here. But I did really like the bookending of – the D&D and the basement and Mike reclaiming his sort of role as storyteller, which, you know, Mike was sidelined and backseated for a couple of seasons there, and he came back into his own in season 5. But I did like how everyone had their role, everyone had their ending, everyone had, you know, their task and what they were moving forward with. And it felt very much like it was saying, you know, these children aren't children. They've grown up.
But
they've passed the torch.
Yeah, they've passed the torch onto the latest crew.
And that was a really nice way. And I understand why so much time was spent wrapping up these stories.
Well, they earned their extended coda, I thought.
Because I agree.
Because Mike looks like Frodo, and if multiple farewells are good enough for Lord of the Rings, it's good enough for them. I also liked, you know, we're talking about some of the most valued players, like, you know, Karen and Joyce and Holly, and also Murray. And his helicopter busting hand grenade.
Yes. No, that was very well timed. There was, and I mean, again, same as in volume 1 of season 5, there was some great action, great set pieces. And I think, you know, there was a lot of chatter about who might die.
Mm.
And in a way, when I think about it, like, it ended the way you should expect a long-running popular Netflix series to end. They're not going to – it's not Game of Thrones. They're not going to want to devastate people.
A red upside down.
They're not going to want to make all these beloved characters. You know, I think it makes sense to me, even though some people feel it's pulled punches, it makes sense that this is meant to be a triumphant, fun undertaking.
Well, it's a true represent – I mean, it's not Predator from the 80s. It's – you know, where there's only two survivors from the group. You know, it's more of one like E.T. or something like that.
It's more about the journey they've been on and emerging out of this story in a certain way, not so much about, you know.
And if you're mongrel enough to say, well, I picked this person to die, well, good luck to you.
And if it makes sense for the story, sure, but there was definitely no points, at least in this season, where I felt, oh, that person should have...
I do like that they really made no attempt to redeem Vecna.
No, which they could have
Henry,
done.
Which they could have done. Mm-hmm. I like the fact that they brought the Mind Flayer back into it in a big way, literally a big way.
Yeah, I think what I thought was interesting is in the final fights, you really do see how much the scale has grown and changed over the season. Like early season 1, you know, the finale, it was in Joyce's house. It was very, like, sort of smaller scale, a bit more scrappy. And, you know, I think it's just the way things have naturally evolved. Like, the budget is bigger, the story is bigger. We were building up to this over seasons. I understand why everything was just so much more massive.
The Demigorgons and the Demibats weren't featured in the or there at all in the final battle. And I thought about that. And I understand that they've been defeated earlier.
Mm.
You know, so I get that.
And that wasn't their realm. That wasn't where they lived.
Well,
it wouldn't make sense for them to be there, I guess.
Yeah, I think they kind of came from there, didn't they? I'm a little bit confused about that.
But there's a few, like, look, I'm not going to lie, there's questions I have and there's things that I think were maybe not wrapped up. But
how did Max get to graduate with the
time that she missed at school?
Yeah. Fast-tracked, obviously. She buckled down after the events and just got fast-tracked.
Max is a very determined character. I reckon she would have just made it happen.
Maximum effort.
Exactly. What about Derek's family? I mean, are they traumatized? We didn't see them again. Did they just die in that barn and everyone was like, oh, well.
Left them tied up.
Derek can just come live with the Byers family.
18 months later, while one of the party is graduating.
Yeah.
And you know, and we don't talk enough about Derek's family and dead silence. Oh, my God.
Well, I mean, I think as well there's some, like I said, there's some hanging threads that I'm like, nah, I'm willing to forgive. And then there's some threads where I'm like, of course they're not going to have Max's mother in these episodes. Of course they're not going to necessarily wrap up Vicky's storyline. We can't have it all. This is a TV series with discrete timeline. We need to just do what we can. People can infer their own things.
There's a scene in the flash forward scene where there's some of them are standing on sitting on the roof of this radio station, and they're talking about what meeting up once a month from thereafter, and that's all very well for them to say, but we as the audience, we know that's not going to happen. There's going to be a month. Maybe they might do it for the first couple of months, but there'll be a month when one of them can't make it, and then two. And it's so poignant.
Yeah, I agree.
Life will move on.
I did. I liked the time we spent sort of in those moments. Yeah. I do think some, not unearned, but I think some really were trying for an emotional level that it didn't quite reach. But overall, I felt it was pretty satisfying. I also don't know, I do have some criticisms around it. I think some of the acting at certain points was a bit off. And there was some things I took issue with. I do not think it's perfect. I think it is a really nice ending to what Stranger Things has been.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me. It was enjoyable. And that's all I want to get out of this. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not expecting anything more than just have an entertaining time and know what happens to these characters at the end of the story.
No BMXs or walkie-talkies were harmed in the making of this production, but Steve lost his car.
I know. Gosh. I said no deaths and I lied. Clearly that Beamer really had it coming. But
I'm going to miss him.
I really think it was a lot of fun. It was a ride. And I think the tone of the show has shifted over the years, but overall in terms of creative, definitely, nostalgic, definitely, and some really good action and enjoyable story in the last bits of wrap-up. So
I think we'll say, because Purple Rain, Princess Purple Rain,
he's a longie. It's a longie.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll save that for the end of the episode.
Yeah, let's go out with that one.
But instead we'll play right now a track called Kids.
Yeah, that's something from the score. It's a really nice piece of music. Just kind of really embodies a bit of Stranger Things, I think, which we have now officially farewelled. Yeah. Although, actually, that's a lie. There is a behind-the-scenes documentary that's coming out on the 12th, which is called One Last Adventure, The Making of Stranger Things 5.
Yes, but it's not actually a hidden secret episode.
It's not Conformity Gate or whatever. I mean, people, I truly worry about the youth of today sometimes and their, like, literacy.
A lot of those things you'll see peak on social media.
Yeah.
And it's just clickbait, basically.
Yeah. And I think people just like to dissect things and analyse and go deep.
Well, that was whole Fechner and Henry's whole thing, but
But yes, let's listen to Kids. This is from Stranger Things School.
Hello, darling. This is Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, stacking Z's on 0G.
That was Kids, and that was by Kyle Dixon, and it's from the Stranger Things score, which we finally farewelled the 10-year-long adventure bike ride that we've had with Stranger Things and the Duffer Brothers. Finally wrapped up. Finale has dropped. And, yeah, that'll be it's not going to be the last we see of Hawkins, Indiana, because I think there's lots of chatter about multi-mode spin-offs.
The animation one's supposed to be set in 85 or something like that.
I think there's books as well, and obviously the stage play was a big part of it. There's already one that exists that talks about Henry's backstory. So, I mean, I think the world will just expand and get bigger and bigger, which, I mean, look, it's amazing. I remember when Stranger Things first came out, it was a very small, it was early days of the Netflix originals. It was a very small word of mouth thing, and then it blew up, and then look where it's gone. And you know, it's pretty amazing, I think.
Turned the world upside down.
Yeah, pretty much. But, yes, so
another long-running saga, Avatar, Fire and Ash.
Mm-hmm.
Saw it in 3D at the local multiplex, which was
You did the 3D.
Yeah, which I particularly wanted to do that. Saw Sigourney Weaver in the trailer for The Mandalorian and Grogu before that, which I thought was interesting, playing a rebel in Chris Nolan's Odyssey movie and the Doomsday trailer, one of the three so far, Steve Rogers, we've seen Thor and X-Men.
Yes.
And got Wonder Man coming out at the end of the month.
Very soon.
Yeah. Anyway, Avatar, Fire and Ash, the third in the James Cameron directed and produced projected five-film series, not to be confused with the popular anime and manga Avatar. Screenplay slash story by James Cameron, Rick Jaffa, Amanda Silver, Josh Friedman, and Shane Salimo. The first Avatar film came out in 2009 with Avatar The Way of Water released in 2022. Long break between then for various reasons. And now Avatar Fire and Ash late last year, began to be shot simultaneously with The Way of Water, pioneering and showcasing bleeding-edge 3D and other advanced filmmaking technology, featuring timeless themes of environmental and cultural exploitation and colonisation, and the pushback against those seen through a science fiction lens, which also includes genre tropes of space commercialism, militarism and colonisation, cloning and world-girding gestalt minds, similar to the concept of Gaia.
Yep.
In the mid-22nd century, spacefaring Earth humans established a mining colony on the moon Pandora, which orbits a gas giant planet in the Alpha Centauri star system, so relatively close to Earth.
Yeah.
There, the Resources Development Administration, the RDA, guarded by a security force of Marines, extracted the immensely valuable room temperature superconducting material, unobtainium, he says with air quotes. It becomes as vital to Earth's homeworld and star-travelling technology as the spice melange is to the Galactic Empire in Dune. And another spice-adjacent resource the humans are exploiting on Pandora is a compound extracted from murdered sentient Pandoran aquatic beings, the Tsalkan, in a lethal process very much like 21st century industrial whaling. And this biological compound acts as a complete anti-aging drug in humans. So they will stop at nothing to get at that too. And the third thing the Terrans are after, as Earth's biosphere collapses, is a new world to live on. So they are now dead set upon wider colonisation of Pandora, in spite of the atmosphere not being breathable by humans and the moon's fauna being actively hostile to mankind, treating them quite rightly as the destructive invaders that they are. And to help facilitate the exploitation, the humans created clones of the large blue felinoid indigenous beings known as the Na'vi. And these clones were able to breathe the atmosphere and live beyond heavily defended human colony perimeters in the Pandoran forest without mostly triggering attacks, and indeed could, under certain circumstances, pass as native Pandorans. This allows the humans to closely study Pandora and the Na'vi for weaknesses. And one of the human avatar pilots that they used was a Marine named Jake Sully, played by Sam Worthington.
Yep.
He was sent to infiltrate a Na'vi tribe and learn their weaknesses, and which went pear-shaped, as Jake, from the human perspective, went native and came to sympathise with the Na'vi, leading them in a successful rebellion against the humans, eventually kicking all but a few sympathetic human scientists off-world, sending them packing back to Earth. In Avatar 2, The Way of Water, we saw the humans return to Pandora 16 Earth years later in much greater force. They were there to stay. And Jake Sully, whose consciousness has now been permanently transferred to his Na'vi clone body, is now the mate of Natiri, played by Zoe Saldana, performance captured, which is still played, and I'm very keen on saying that because these are incredibly intricate performances. And they now have three Na'vi children together, two sons and an adopted daughter, a Na'vi child called Kiri, who is the orphan daughter of Earth scientist Grace Augustine's avatar clone, born in mysterious, may I say, virgin birth circumstances. Also voiced by Sigourney Weaver is the younger one, and she does a marvellous job playing the younger voice.
Yes, I remember that.
Full of wonder and big-eyed sort of amazement. But she's growing up in this one. They're also looking after, that is to say the Sullies, are also looking after a young human child, and they couldn't send them back to Earth with the rest of the survivors because human babies can't endure the cryogenic stasis necessary to survive star travel. Young boy is now growing up as a teenager. His name is Spider, and he's the son of Na'vi's greatest human foe.
Right.
Colonel Miles Quatrich. Now, he has to use a breathing mask as a human on Pandora, and those batteries have to be recharged at regular intervals, so there's a built-in thing there. Jake and the Sullys are being hunted by the human forces, especially by Quaritch, who is now a permanent Avatar clone himself after the original was killed in Avatar 1. The humans are once again handed a defeat by the Pandoran Na'vi working with the aquatic Tolkans, this time at sea, but not a big enough victory to repel the bridgehead on the moon. So there's much bloodshed amongst which the Sully's oldest son was killed in the Way of Water.
Mm.
Now, Fire and Ash picks up very soon after that, so right. No 16-year wait this time. And it is still very much a family-orientated story, perhaps yep. not necessarily orientated to watch by a family, but, you know, that depends upon
but
you.
But the Sullys are kind of the focus, right?
Yeah. Jake and his family are still living amongst the Na'vi Sea tribes. They're still being hunted
mm-hmm.
by the Earth forces. They're devastated by the death of their oldest son. Jake is losing himself in that.
Mm.
He's also doubting his ability to be an effective combatant in this ongoing right. war. And Jake is particularly hard on the surviving son, Loak, who was played by Britton Dalton, who also blames himself for his brother being killed in a firefight with the humans.
Oh, okay.
So they double down on that. And that story is paralleled by Loak's connection with his spiritual brother in the Tulkan, the aquatic whale-like creatures yep. Called Payakan. And he's got this sign that the story travels together with that.
Mm.
And he's an outcast too.
Yeah.
So there's lots of complications there, which I really appreciate. It opens up the nuance of the character arcs.
Yeah, yeah.
Zoe Saldana is still playing Natiri, mm-hmm. And she is off balance from leaving her forest clan
yeah.
and seeking sanctuary with the Metkayina Sea Clan. She's mourning her oldest son.
Mm.
Off screen, and I didn't find this out until recently, her younger sister was killed by the Marines before the events of the first Avatar movie, gunned down in front of her eyes.
That's canon from some other...
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
She's understandably overcome with hatred for the humans.
Mm.
She places her in conflict with her partially human husband,
mm.
Jake, and his protection of the human boy, Spider. And she's kind of moved away from the way of yeah. the spiritual connection with Awa, the Gaia surrogate in this story. Jake's champion plays Spider, and he does a great job of portraying his frustration at being the son of, like, Darth Vader.
Mm.
And he's trying to physically keep up with the much larger and more agile and powerful Pandorans. And he's handicapped by that breath mask that he has to watch all the time. Well, a really great performance from that.
Interesting.
That kid. And Kiri is the daughter of Grace's Na'vi avatar, of course. Her powers are growing. But she, too, is having trouble connecting with Awa. So there's more parallels there.
Okay.
And this world mind that you can plug into, okay, it's a spiritual thing, but it is also a science fiction idea, as it probably ties in with the superconductor-rich environment.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not pluribus. It's a different sort of story. But, I'm very interested in the way that turns out. There's one other daughter too, Trinity Jolie Bliss playing Tuck Teary, the very youngest child,
right.
who is cute as a button and given a bit more agency in this movie than she was in Way of the Water, where she was like a MacGuffin sort of.
They'll probably build on that, I guess, in the next one.
I guess, yeah. Mm. She could grow up into movie 4 and 5 easily. Yeah. There is a mass gathering of the Tolkien whale creatures, which is an opportunity for the human colonists in Fire and Ash to kill them on a large scale to obtain the anti-aging compound, more vile human behaviour,
mm.
led by Eddie Falco playing General Francis Ardmore, who's Quaritch's superior officer in command of the big RDA bridgehead. Blunt, pragmatic, she presides over the bridgehead base, which is grim and industrial military.
Mm.
If it's a little Earth, then things are very bad indeed back on Terra. We've also got Una Chaplin
yes.
Playing Varang.
Speaking of Red Wedding.
Yeah. She's the leader of the volcano-based Mankwan clan.
Where the fire and ash comes in, I suppose.
Yeah. And she's an interesting example of how A culture can be twisted by colonisation.
Mm.
This is the direct impact of that, and she's been hardened by that and driven quite maniacal.
Right.
Nevertheless, Una Chaplin is playing this role. She says it's a great role.
Yeah.
And, you know, yes, she's one of those chaplains. We've seen her playing Talissa in Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. She was in a Black Mirror episode called White Christmas.
White Christmas.
And the actress did salsa, flamenco and ballet quite early on in her life, and that's actually informs the standout physicality of her motion capture performance in this. She is one to watch, and also... this is a little bit of a spoiler, but kind of the love interest for Quaritch. There's this marriage of convenience kind of thing going on here. Oh, unexpected.
It's a long movie, Robertson.
Yeah.
Over 3 hours. How did you hold up throughout that runtime? Did you think it...
Easy.
Was an earned... Because 3 hours, 17 minutes is quite a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I just peed in the water. No, I didn't. No, it didn't drag on me. I tell you what, though, there is – we'll get to that in a minute, but there are several other Narvian humans featured from the previous movies. We've got Kate Winslet, Jermaine Clement appearing again, and Brendan Cowell, the Aussie Ahab-like whaling skipper who mysteriously somehow survived from the first film. Technology. David Thewlis comes in as a Na'vi leader of a clan called the Wind Traders, whose mode of transport is completely wondrous and reminds you of all those fantasy illustrations. I won't tell you exactly what it reminds you of. I thought there were similar narrative beats to return to something we were talking about before, to the second film in particular. It didn't bother me too much, but it was in the background of my mind as I'm watching this long movie.
Yeah.
I can see how it could bother you, but I took it as kind of representing a military conflict that was flowing backwards and forwards over the same, water in this case. Because that often happens. You get the same sort of echoes of that. I don't think it's particularly lazy writing, but I could, if you want to say that, go ahead.
You want to see something new and fresh in the fourth one, though, I'd say. Then.
Absolutely.
Like, he needs to change up the formula then.
And there's still that problem of the white saviour. And look, I'm not the one to tell First Nations people anywhere who've been colonised not to take offence at that. At the same time, so this is not a but, at the same time, this is a unique situation. First off, Jake can literally go native with the sci-fi technology involved. And also, there's a big disadvantage that the Pandorans are under. Natural physical advantages aside, World Gestalt fighting on their side as well. They're fighting people who can build starships and can travel between solar systems.
Yeah, and again, not even playing field as it oft is
with it's not even close.
That situation.
You know, it's not like the Zulus at Isandlwana. I'm pretty proud of myself to be able to pronounce that correctly, or the Ethiopians in against colonial Italy, or even the Sioux against Custer.
Mm.
It's a big difference, and they need all the edge that they can get. Having said that, they could probably have handled it a little bit better.
Mm.
I may be making Jake the advisor
to
the Na'vi leader or something instead of actually having him supplant
in the role.
There are some powerful emotional moments, one in particular that I found gut-wrenching. And I enjoyed this film and its increased nuance and the literal deeper dive into world building and exploration as well as exploitation.
Yep.
It's seen through the family filter tinged with consequences of loss and PTSD, impact of the colonisation on Pandoran culture, the ongoing mystery of Grace. And, there's a fair bit of people being taken captive and escaping.
Yeah.
They do take some pains to explain how they do that because there's like somebody keeping an eye on that just to say, we'd better have a little line here. I appreciate that. I like that there's plenty of un and under the water action, ocean capture as you might call it.
Yeah.
Where they still put the human actors through that, too.
Yeah.
They didn't just say, we'll just replace you with that. We'll actually put you underwater.
Well, because Kate Winslet famously beat Tom Cruise's underwater breath-holding record. Yeah. Good for Kate.
There's lots of frilling aviating this time, so it's all mixed in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what Cameron says. The appeal is obviously the technology, playing around with the visuals and some of that, cutting-edge techniques and... whatnot.
See it in 3D. It'll take your breath away.
I mean, I'll be honest, Rob. I've not seen Way of Water.
Mm-hmm.
I probably won't see. I have nothing against Avatar series. I really enjoyed the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
I've just never felt I needed to return to the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But you'll be staying on for 4 and 5 then?
Yeah, I reckon I will. They have to do a lot more wrong than they did in this to kick me off.
Yeah.
I mean, fantastic aviation, environmental themes, anti-colonization themes, kick-ass young women, anti-militarism.
All your favourite things, Rob.
Am I sure this isn't a live-action Studio Ghibli film? I don't know.
I mean, Cameron clearly has a clear vision for what he wants out of this. Like, this is – he said somewhere that, you know, he wants to do these as long as they're creatively challenging him. I think someone had said something like, you know, do you feel you're wasting your talent by just making these Avatar movies? And he was basically like, this is what I want to be doing. It challenges me.
Mm.
Get lost, basically. And I think he clearly is very deeply – he likes this world. These are the movies he wants to make.
And it's science fiction directly mirroring real life events. There's no two ways about it.
And probably more than ever, he's probably, you know, very invested in making films with those messages. I mean,
for God's sake, we've got President Trump wanting to go into other countries and doing it, and to take resources. If that's top, you know, the RDA and Pandora, I don't know what it is.
But I mean, yeah. So nothing against Avatar. I think it's just, you know, in the world of there's so much out there to watch.
Do you know there's moments in each of these films which I just remember. Because they were just so stunning. Mm. And sometimes they're not the moments you think. Like in Way of the Water, there's this bit where Kiri is just floating in the shallows looking down at the play of light and shadow.
And I mean, that's,
on the sand.
Filmmaking.
This one, it was when the Tolkien matriarchs are speaking in the water with their sonar, and you feel that in your water and it creates standing waves.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, oh, my gosh, this is science fiction. This is telling me something I've never seen before.
And I think another clear encouragement to see it in the cinema and to see it in 3D. And, I mean, anything that's going to get people into cinemas is a good thing.
Is there going to be more movies? Well, I said if it doesn't make enough money, they won't. It made $1.1 billion globally.
This is what's great. Everyone's like, who's seen these movies? A lot of people.
It still feels like an event movie to see at IMAX or in 3D.
Yeah.
They've keep doing that, and I think, yeah, all right.
I think he'll get the green light for 4.
And here's the thing. I'm wondering if if Awa might end up colonising Earth to stop the human attacks.
Well, because what's he got? He's done fire, water. What's the next?
Yes,
he's planned them, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, would they call that Pandora forming Earth? Perhaps to restore its ruined biosphere? Like, this is what I would do.
I mean, there are lots of possibilities. I can kind of see, in terms of a creative paddling pool, Cameron could do worse.
Yeah. Look, there are problems, obviously. But again, like Stranger Things, that hasn't really turned me off the series.
Yeah, I agree. I think you can acknowledge the flaws and things that you didn't like without being totally off a whole. That's how I'm approaching 2026 in general.
Yeah. All right, that's it for Zero G for today. And we will go out with, I think, Purple Rain.
Yeah, so I think what was interesting is there was a lot of teasing about how in the last episode there was a track that was used that was really hard to get that wasn't really used in any other film before.
Yep.
And then, it was Purple Rain because Prince's estate is very rarely gives the green light for his tracks to be used.
But in light of Kate Bush's success, re-success.
they came around, so. Yeah.
It is a relevant song. It has the elements in it that make sense in context of Stranger Things.
Let's hear Purple Rain from Prince. Kate Reid coming up next with Astral Glamour.
Thank you, Megan.
Thank you, Rob.
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Triple R's Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.